Yeah. Okay, let's get started. Thanks for coming on this rainy, sunny day. And this is the last week of lectures. We'll have a lecture today and on Thursday, and next Tuesday will be the student presentation, so you want to be sure to come to that. And a week from Thursday will be our celebration, so we'll be doing some course evaluations. Everybody's welcome to attend. And then we'll maybe eat some burritos, and I'll have a sign-up sheet for that. So, any questions on any of the stuff we've talked about? Just always want to ask, just in case. So, I thought it'd be interesting to check out some old technology, and then on Thursday we'll check out some new technology. But this is what wheelchairs were like back in the 20s, and you can see that they were handmade out of wood, maybe not a huge cushion in the back, two big wheels in front, and a single castered wheel in the back. Here's a bunch of wounded men at the White House in 1924. Again, you can see the design is sort of open, sort of wicker design. Looks like the same chairs with a single caster wheel behind it. Again, made out of wood. And here's an all-wood chair. Sort of looks like what you find on a deck. But again, you see some adjustability here for the armrests and for the leg rests, again, I'm not sure this is made to even have a cushion on it or not, and the wheel position where it is may make it sort of hard to drive. So this is a little bit newer design, and this was a company back, they were in Santa Clara, and this whole thing is a wheelchair, okay, and it actually had two ways that it worked. It had the standard driven, power-driven wheels. And then it actually had a tank tread in here, and it used that to climb upstairs backwards. And as you climbed up the stairs, the chair repositioned itself so that you would be upright. And it was a very nice design, and it was sponsored by Foster's Beer, and they spent a lot of money on it, and it was a very nice design, but it never made it to market. It was very heavy. I couldn't tell you, but it was made out of all aircraft quality components and ISO 9000, process. That was probably early to mid 80s. And so, in going up the stairs, the treads would work, and if you were on level ground, the wheels would engage. So the tank treads actually lowered to the floor. So it was pretty interesting. And this is actually a prototype that we did at the VA. And the interesting thing here is these wheels. These are these Ezekiel wheels that have that roll. They work like a regular wheel, but these are actually rollers that would and that gives it a really interesting property. And on this chair, there's three of these wheels, and they're all faced in a different way, and by operating the wheels independently, you can get the thing to go forward, backwards, pivot on its own axis, and go sideways, which was really neat. This was the prototype for this wheelchair, which was the second iteration called the Alexis, and this was made in Palo Alto. Used a similar type of wheel design with the rollers on the wheels. Sort of like what Ralph Hotchkiss showed us. And this was really, really slick. We had a Recaro racing seat and a three-axis force joystick. And we had this actually up in Canada for a conference. It was very neat. Again, got to the brink of commercialization, and the company failed. So, but it was a good design, and developed at the VA. So there's this concept of making devices that you would want to wear, and one way of doing that is making them really fashionable using a little bit of design and making it look interesting more, you know, beyond utility. I'm not sure how functional this is. This just may be a model, but sort of interesting. This is a very, very early version of this FES walking system, and FES stands for functional electric stimulation. And basically what you do is you have either skin electrodes or electrodes through the skin that stimulate various muscles in synchrony for walking. This is a very early one. Now, you still have to have, you know, a cane or something for your balance. It was sort of mindless. You know, you become the robot, and this thing sort of moves your legs for you. This is for people who are paralyzed in their legs. But you can see, you know, maybe from using the system, the guy's legs are pretty meaty. So that's sort of interesting. And this is Dr. Marcellet from the VA, and he did a lot of work in this. And I think I was at this session, and he had a bunch of, you know, his subjects walk. And there was one guy who could actually walk pretty quickly, very fast. And but they used electrodes, you know, into the muscle, through the skin, into the muscle. But the problem is that they couldn't get the wires out afterwards. So he had a lot of wires sort of, you know, lost in his leg. And, of course, that's not good for you. And after a while, they really gave him problems. But it worked pretty well. Here's a very early prosthetic arm that is chin-controlled. So you have a little joystick mounted near the chin, and you nudge the joystick with your chin, and it operates parts of this prosthetic hand. Although it looks like, you know, that's his real hand here, and this is just it's like an exoskeleton system. So, interesting design. So, contrast that with this FES grasp control. So, this is an FES system that's pretty much embedded within the person, and there's actually wires going up through the arm to the hand, and it only does one thing. It enables you to open and close your hand probably in two separate ways, this pinch-type grip and this strong-type grip. And, you know, once you have a grip like that, you can do a lot of things. You know, you can put your hand around a can of beer, you know. You can put your hand around, you know, utensils and be able to feed yourself or put on makeup. So all these things are pretty important. And this is Dr. Creasy was at the Cleveland Center for many years, and this is probably some of his work. Now that they have an implantable system that is FDA approved, and I know that they've implanted a couple people at Stanford and the VA with the system. This is an early attempt to have a feeding aid. If you can't grab the spoon or fork yourself, well, you have a robot do it for you. And so this is sort of interesting. I think this plate is rotatable, and then there's a wiper here that sort of gathers all the food in one place so that the spoon or fork can pick it up and present it to the feeder. Here's a little bit nicer looking design. And here we have a beverage holder as well. And it looks like it may be operated through this mechanism here. Not sure. So this is a very early environmental control system. An environmental control is a device that used by people who don't have use of their arms or legs. And basically what you do is you blow and suck into a straw, and it activates a pneumatic switch that steps through a bunch of functions on this panel here. And those functions could be, you know, turning on a light, operating the bed, turning on the TV or radio and changing channels, and operating the nurse call and operating the emergency light. So that was all done in this box here and this display here. And it was a very early design, all electromechanical, no computers. So that was sort of fun. Let's pass around the sign-up sheet. Here's a more advanced version of that. Now, this is probably computer-controlled here. They have this X10 system, which allows you to wirelessly turn on and off things at various outlets. The way you operate it is putting your arm into these slots, and those are switches there. And so, again, you have you step through various functions, maybe with one switch, and then when you get to the function that you want, you hit it, you activate it with a second switch. This is a voice-controlled environmental control system called Butler in a Box, and so it would respond to your commands. It was smart enough to understand what you were saying. You'd have to train it, but it was actually pretty good for the time. Again, probably early to mid-80s. An eye gaze system. If you don't have use of your arms or legs, you know, one way to activate things is to point to them with your eyes. So this was the rationale behind this particular eye gaze system. Here's a little bit different system where you have a camera here, and it's looking at your eyes, and it can determine where you're looking. And you can type by looking at each character at a time. And someplace around here, here's a little display where the letters accumulate into a message. So a very big device. I'm not sure it was very successful, or I'm not sure it worked very well either. Switches are a big thing. If you don't have use of your hands, but you can move your arm around, you can whack a switch, and here's a bunch of switches, all different kinds. Here's an arm slot switch, a directional switch. Here's a joystick that's operated with your chin. You just this goes over your chin, and you can activate switches. You can activate, if you have enough range of motion, you can activate multiple switches. There's some switches that are made to be hit with your head if you're in a wheelchair, and that's the only thing that you can move. Or, you know, with your feet or whatever, wherever you can move, that's where they put a switch to activate something. And one of those things that they'd activate is a communication system. This is for people who can't type but can move this slider around, and they just point to a letter and hold it there, and the letter gets probably displayed on this display here and printed out. And so you can communicate that way if you're non-vocal and you don't have good use of your hands. And everybody remembers Speak and Spell made by Texas Instruments. It was a device that you can type in words and it would speak them for you. Remember that? Yeah.
I do. You said everybody, and I was wondering how many everybody.
Well, this was a commercial device. I mean, it wasn't meant for the disability market, but it did have some people made good use of it. Okay, so much for our walk back in time. On Thursday, we're going to have Rich Mahoney from SRI. He's going to be talking about robotic applications and specifically how you commercialize them. And so he's sort of a new person there heading up their robotics applications program. They're doing a lot of stuff with elderly and disabled, so we can hear an update about that. But today, we have John Folio, who's from Stanford, and he manages the Stanford Online Accessibility Program, SOAP. And as a memento, when you go to some of their sessions, they'll actually give you a bar of soap. I have one at home. They have a mission to provide guidance to the Stanford community as they use various online means to share information. The program has a mandate to assist web designers and online content creators in producing material that is accessible to the greatest audience possible. John's going to talk to us about universal accessibility web standards And John's from Canada. And he's been creating and managing websites for 12 years in Canada for the government of Canada and various agencies up there, and he's familiar with the whole stream of technology and stuff that's coming. So please, let's welcome John Folliot. Folio.
You want to record this, huh? I'm sorry, which is forward?
Yeah. This one? Okay. This is your lightsaber.
Well, I probably won't need that. Okay, cool. So, mahalo, and thank you, David. I'm John, and yes, I'm Canadian, and we won the hockey game, yay. We had to win that hockey game. And as David said, I run the Stanford Online Accessibility Program. I've been here at Stanford for about 3.5 years now, and I work primarily with faculty and staff as we get content on the web. As David mentioned, I've been working web accessibility for about a decade now, doing web development for about 12 years. And prior to coming to Stanford, I was operating as an independent consultant. And I did a lot of consulting work with the Canadian federal government as they were putting stuff online and ensuring it was accessible. So that's my background. I wanted very quickly, this is something of a pre-canned presentation to have here. And so I always like to try and just gauge, you know, who's in my audience. So how many people here are content authors that you'd be actually sort of creating material just to go up on a website? I know David is. And okay. And so at this point, it's just authoring. How many are designers, come from a graphics or an artistic kind of background, visual implementation and whatnot? Okay. And how many people here are web weenies, technical, worked with HTML and stuff like that? Okay, so we've got a good mix. Each one of these roles has a play, each one of these actors has a role to play in creating accessible web content. So I have a buddy of mine, Aaron Leventhal. He was working at IBM. He's currently out on his own right now. And he had this really great quote, and it's that we don't want accessibility to be the thing that limits people or what they can do on their website. We're not trying to slow down progress of the web. We're trying to say, take accessibility into account. And so a lot of what I talk to people about is exactly that. It's about thinking through the ramifications of what we're doing when we put content on the web to ensure that it's as inclusive as possible. So when we start looking at accessibility issues and accessibility issues for content that's on the web, the four basic sort of access barriers all come meeting together one place. Probably the most obvious and the easiest one to sort of grasp, because the web is such a visual medium, is in fact visual impairments. And so I'm going to presume that this class has a fairly good idea of what it means, but for what it means for me is that it can range from total blindness to low vision, reduced vision, nearsighted, farsighted. I always tease my dad, his arms are shrinking, he can't see the phone numbers in the phone book anymore, as well as issues such as color blindness and those kinds of related issues. I'm always asked, well, how many people does this affect? And so about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, Microsoft commissioned a study. It was conducted by Forrester Research, which is a very prestigious research organization. So the data is, I won't say it's beyond question, but we can interpret or take the interpretation of the data with a high degree of confidence. And their survey said that about 17% of U.S. computer users reported having some kind of visual difficulty or impairment from severe to mild. They don't really spread it out more than that. And so people in this group will often use some kind of adaptive technology. I was asked before the class started if I was going to talk about screen readers. How many people here have actually experienced the screen reader? So a screen reader is a technology that actually sits on the computer system one layer above the operating system. So for the most part, we see it on the Windows platform. There are screen readers that have been developed for Linux. Mac, there were screen readers developed for Mac, and then Apple has introduced VoiceOver, which is tightly bound with their operating system. But what these things do is they actually parse the text on screen, and they will read it aloud using a mechanical voice. Some of the voices have become very good. David, have you talked about any of this and looked at any of it? So there, you can load different voice profiles. There's male voices, female voices, English accents, French language packs, et cetera, et cetera. And they can read the text on screen. Of course, the issue becomes, if you have an image on a screen or if you have text embedded in an image, what are we going to do? And we'll talk about that in a second. The second group that may be affected by some of the things we do on the web is people with auditory impairments. And so that includes people with partial or total hearing loss. But I also think of it in terms of embracing environments where sound would be very difficult to perceive. Noisy environments or places where sound would be inappropriate, i.e. a library, or perhaps you're using an appliance or a computer system that may not have speakers attached to it or a sound card or something like that. Again, roughly 20%, 18% of computer users have reported having some kind of hearing impairment or difficulty, with about 2%, 2.5 million people reporting having severe hearing difficulty or impairment. Again, that same Microsoft survey. So a sizable group of people. In terms of where it's going to impact the most is normally when we see multimedia being used on the web. And for me, this is actually an area of I'm very concerned about, and I've been actually doing a lot of work personally in this particular space, because more and more we're starting to see multimedia show up as a fully fledged member of web content. Who here has never been to YouTube? That's what I thought. So, I mean, there is a perfect case of media being used on a regular basis. And so we need to ensure that for people that have auditory impairments, when we're providing multimedia, whether it's movies or whatnot, that we don't leave them behind. And so we need to provide alternative text or ideally time-stamped caption files that are synchronized with the video so that we essentially have the web equivalent of closed captions, which, you know, anytime you have lunch up at the treehouse or your favorite sports bar or something, we always see the TV's got closed captioning on it. Mobility impairments is another one that people don't think about, but it can, in fact, have an impact on people accessing content on the web. Again, it runs the gamut from severe mobility impairments, quadriplegics, paraplegics, people with arthritis or Parkinson's or cerebral palsy, any of those kind of neuromuscular impairments that may get in the way. Extreme youth. You know, we talk about gross motor control versus fine motor control. If ever you've seen little kids coloring, they can never keep the crayons inside of the line because they lack fine motor control. Extreme age. And so these things may impact on people interacting with your website if the target is too small to click on for somebody that doesn't have fine motor control. It can also be due to temporary conditions, and I love this picture because you've got two young ladies that both have their right hands in a cast, which means that for a period of a couple of weeks, they're not going to be able to use a mouse the way they normally would. And if you've ever tried to use your mouse in your opposite hand, you'll know how difficult that is. Again, the numbers kind of, you know, there's a pattern here. They're all just slightly below 20% here at 19%. With about 5% having a severe mobility impairment. And David was talking about switches and some of the different switches that are out here, and mobility impairments very much will take advantage of switches, whether it's sip and puff mechanisms or foot switches, hand switches, head-activated mice. I have some friends that actually have a company up in Canada, and they have a little piece of software that will, I think it's like $50 for the software, and it'll turn a common ball cam, you know, like the little camera that you get for your computer, or even laptops now come embedded with a camera in the screen, and it turns that into a tracking mouse so that you can actually move your head around and the mouse moves around on the screen, and two shakes to the left is a left click and two shakes to the right is a right click. It's really cool. It's very cool software. Probably the hardest issue that we have to deal with when we're thinking about content that goes on the web, however, is people with cognitive impairments. And that one's really easy, but it's also very difficult to understand. And so on the easy end, I mean people that have severe neurological damage, Down syndrome, for example, or, you know, what we used to say when we used politically incorrect words, people that were mentally retarded or mentally developed you know, so those are easy. But it's also hard to provide content for that user group. But then we also look at things like low literacy skills, dyslexia, cultural differences, and language differences, you know, English as a second or third language and whatnot. Again, about 16% of computer users have some form of cognitive disability. Oftentimes that kind of manifests as kind of a dyslexic or reading disability. And so there's not a lot of mechanical techniques that we can really apply to address those barriers. Clear and effective communication is important. Knowing your target audience. Say things simple when you can. You don't need to embellish. And so writing style comes into play here. So the fifth one is not really a barrier, but it's one that I always like to remind people about, and that's that of technical restrictions. And again, if we're going to look at the spectrum, on the low end of the scale, there's connectivity issues and older software. You know, I think the most recent studies tell us that approximately 45% of the American population is still accessing the web over dial-up. Think about that. Okay, 45%, almost half the population is still connecting the web versus dial-up. So if you're shoving huge files up on the web, you're really seriously degrading their ability to access and consume content on the web. We also, at the other end, it's the cutting edge, and so, you know, the iPhone, right, the poster child of the mobile handheld computing revolution. Mobile web browsing is growing. It's starting to take off in North America. It's been a factor in places like Europe and Asia for quite some time. And surprisingly enough, in third world countries as well, where they don't have an infrastructure with a lot of fiber optic cable or copper cable, but it's relatively cheap to throw up a cell tower, and so they're all accessing the web on their mobile phones. Finally, we also have alternate delivery platforms like the Xbox, the Wii, PlayStation. All of these things now are becoming web-enabled. They can actually plug into the network, and we can stream content to these tools as well. So we need to think about that in terms of when we're developing content for the web. We never know what kind of device is actually going to be consuming our final product. So there's been a lot of work in terms of how to make content for the web accessible. And I guess the international sort of gold standard is something that was created by the W3C. It's the World Wide Web Consortium. And they have something called their Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. It's also known in the business as WCAG or WCAG, WCAG. We're now using WCAG 2, which became a standard around Christmas of 2008, beginning of 2009. So it's about a year old now, and it supersedes the original version that was released in 1999. The new WCAG 2 is based on four founding principles. Your content must be perceivable, operable, understandable, and robust, and the acronym is POUR, P-O-U-R. Perceivable means that information and user interface components must be presentable to users in ways that they can perceive. Seems pretty straightforward, but what it means is that you need to be able to understand what's going on. And that can be tricky, you know? So if we hide content off screen. I'll give you a perfect example. How many times have you gone to a website and when you go to actually start navigating the menu, and all of a sudden a little drop down and six buttons fly out or eight buttons fly out and whatnot, right? And so what's happened is that the web developer has decided that for economy of screen real estate, they're going to tuck all of those links out of the way until you need them. Now it could be argued that that's good usable design, but I would turn around and say that it's poor usable design, and here's why. We talked earlier about screen reading technology, and so just because you've visually hidden those links out of sight doesn't mean that they're not there. They still exist. And so the danger is that when you can hide many links out of sight until you need them, people tend to overload those menus. And so it may only look like there's five buttons that will actually reveal another 48 buttons below, but for the screen reading user, they have to listen to 48 plus 5. They have to listen to 53 links every single time a page loads. So we want to be careful that we don't get in the way of their ability to perceive the greater structure of the navigation. It needs to be operable. The user interface and the components must be navigable without being reliant on a specific technology. So, for example, if you can't use a mouse and yet the only way to get information is to take the mouse and hover over something on screen, you've got a problem there. Right? And so there's techniques that we can do to ensure that that content is made accessible so that instead of using a mouse, you can tab using the tab key on the keyboard to get to it. And very often for people that have mobility impairments and whatnot, that tab key is also can be hooked up to any number of alternate switching devices, SIP and PUF. I always have a hard time with that one, or foot switches, head switches, and whatnot. So, again, it needs to be operable in that kind of way. The information needs to be understandable. And again, I mean, that sounds very basic. Information and the operation of user interfaces must be understandable. You must be able to figure it out. And so sometimes web developers will get too tricky for their own good. You know, oh, look what I can do. This is really slick. And they have things spinning around and coming out. You know, and it's like, on one hand, it's a thought exercise. It's very interesting to sort of push the envelope and see where we go. But you want to make sure that the basic usability and the usability information and architecture is very basic and very sound and very solid. You can layer other things on top. But if the entire thing is cotton candy of whiz-bang, but the structure is really poor underneath, then it's not understandable. People get lost very often. And I'm sure everybody in this room has been to a website at least once where you sort of go, well, I'm looking for something and I wish I could just find it, right? And you can't. They make you jump through a million and one hoops. That's poor accessible design. Finally, robust. It must be robust enough that it can be interpreted reliably by a wide variety of user agents. So in my business, in the web accessibility business, and the web in general, a user agent is generally thought of as the browser. But as I mentioned earlier, the browser now is expanding into set-top boxes like the Wii and the Xbox and whatnot. So we use that more generic term. And we also need to make sure that it's available to assistive technologies as well. So again, you know, it's not mouse dependent, or you have to be able to type something. I mean, we're starting to see, you know, touch interfaces and whatnot. So we really need to think about all of the ramifications of our user agents as we start rolling out content. Have I lost anybody yet? If we fail in any one of these four areas, which kind of map back to the four different disability barriers that we talked about, then content will not be accessible. And so the W3C guidelines or recommendation is based just on those four basic principles. But then what happens, and I'm not going to go into the details today because it's not a web development course, but once we understand the principles and the guidelines, they've now created a series of what they call success criteria. And so it says, to achieve this particular goal, here are some strategies. And so what they've tried to do at the W3C is rather than be prescriptive, do this, or do this, what they do instead is they say, here's a scenario, here's some possible solutions. Think about what it is that is being done to solve a problem. Can you think of another way? And so the success criteria is actually an evolving document. As new technologies emerge, as new ways of doing things start to appear on the horizon, and web technologies, I mean, man, you close your eyes for 2 minutes and you've missed something. Honest to God, it's moving that fast. But as these new technologies evolve, we can start to incorporate them into the standards. So it's a very intelligent design for standards. Many of these usability guidelines that are kind of focused for people with disabilities actually will improve the user experience for all of your consumers, all of the people that come to your website, including, and this one I love, my best friend Google, right? So we'll talk about that. This includes issues that block access or interfere with access to the web. So, right. So here it is. What's in it for me? There's a website out there called websitesthatsuck.com. If you're ever looking for a way to kill a couple of minutes, it's good fun. And it's been around since Adam was a Boy Scout. Vincent Flanders is the guy's name. And he was quoted as saying, I'm not selling to the blind, so why should I go to the trouble of making my website accessible? Because the most powerful internet force known to God and man visits your page like a blind person, and that's Google. Okay? Something to really think about, right? There's a business case for making content on the web accessible. Because if Google can eat your website easily, and I'll use that terminology, then you will get a higher ranking, you'll show up higher on the Google search results, and everybody wants to be number one because you can only have one number one, right? And so having a well-structured, accessible website actually improves your search engine results, and very quickly, I might add. So to me, that's the number one sales point. So there's a couple of, we need to make the case. And so one of the things that I do here, I mean, I work with content developers and I go and I help them try and understand the technology and we try and match solutions to specific problems. But then another part of my job is just going out and actually making the case for accessible web content. And so there's a couple of different ways that we can approach this. If you're working as part of a team that's putting together web content, so here's some of the things that need to be considered. So first of all, when you create accessible web content, it actually reduces the amount of site development and maintenance time. And the reason for that is that we rely very heavily on existing standards. And the standards that are being generated by the W3C have accessibility included into them as a foundational aspect of the creation of the standard. So accessibility, as I'm sure most of you have come to realize right now, is a foundational thing. We need to start thinking about accessibility at the beginning of the process and not at the 11th hour. Okay? It allows us to enable content for different configurations, write it once and use it many, many times. And so if you design your web content well, it can be displayed on a large screen, on a large monitor on the desktop, or it can be done so that it actually can be consumed on a smart device like your handheld, or it can be sent to the Wii or the Xbox or what have you. It's platform agnostic, it's user agent agnostic. And the other thing is that by using the design techniques that are employed to make accessible content, believe it or not, you're actually future-proofing your content. It doesn't become dated very quickly. We have a serious problem here at Stanford. I'll tell you a dirty little secret at Stanford. There's software that the university uses right now to do key business functions. I won't tell you what they are, but there are key business functions that the university must do. The software was written to be delivered. The user interface has been delivered on the web, but it can only be used in Internet Explorer 6. That browser is now over 10 years old. It is the scourge of web developers worldwide. There are movements out there, kill IE6, and yet we have software here on campus right now that was written that will only work in IE6. Why? Because they didn't follow standards. They didn't care about accessibility. They cared about, well, it looks great on the screen to me, so let's ship. Right? Horrible place to be. Social reasons. Ah, that's a good one. So if you have a website that is accessible, you're probably not going to get a medal for it. It's just the reality. But if you have a website that's not accessible, then you may, in fact, end up in the on the front pages, if not the business section, maybe even the main news section. Target department stores, Target.com, went through a very expensive legal challenge. There's an advocacy rights group called the NFB, the National Federation for the Blind, that launched a challenge against Target.com because their website was inaccessible. Here's the really sad thing. They must have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on lawyers and about 10% or about $10,000 on actually fixing their website. If they just fixed the website in the first place, they could have saved themselves hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they weren't smart about it, you know. Again, we mentioned about the improved usability. So if you create an accessible website, it's just easier for everybody to use. And if you've got a website that just works, you're going to get, if it's a e-commerce site, you're going to get completion of sales. If it's an information site, you're going to have people getting the information they're looking for and moving on. If it's an entertainment site that just works, people will continue to come and they will be entertained. So whatever the reason for putting content on the web, if it works and if it's built using accessible design, it will work well for everybody. And so you will, from that will flow positive benefits to you. Increase the interaction between your site and your end user. So again, a lot of this is kind of businessy, but I mean, you know, David mentioned earlier about products and taking it to market, right? And so whether we agree with it or not, whether we like it or not, in Western society, the monetization of of intellectual property, of content, of taking things to market is kind of how our society works, right? We all need to make a living. And so, you know, the web has become a delivery platform for people to make a living. There's financial reasons. Okay, if you have to start creating multiple versions of your website for different delivery platforms, for, you know, for the PC and the Mac and for the handhelds and whatnot, then you have to start creating multiple versions. In the early bad old days of web accessibility, one of the things that would happen is that you'd get this really graphics heavy, lots of images, and we all remember the dancing mailbox and the flames. I mean, we all seen that stuff and laugh at it now, but I mean, that was the way it was, and then it was like, there was this proviso that said, and if you couldn't take that whiz-bang, flashy, dancing mailbox website and make it accessible, you could make a text-only version. Okay? If anybody here has ever done any kind of software development ever, you'll recognize right away that what we've done is we've introduced a fork. Right? We now have two similar but parallel things operating. And the biggest problem with creating a fork is maintain both of them at the same level, right? And so you don't want to do that. You want to do it once, and then that's the one, and that's the one, right? We talked about search engine ranking. And so for businesses in particular, if you're on page 17 of the Google search results, you might as well not be there. Because I don't know how many people have gone. Who's ever been to page 17 at Google? Yeah, okay, so maybe what? Twice in your lifetime, you know? Usually by the time you get to about page 4, page 5, hey, if it's not there, it's not there. You got to be really, really persistent to start, you know, drilling any deeper than that. So, well, okay, so you were looking for your web page, right? So here's the thing. If you built your website with accessibility stuff intact, I guarantee you'd probably be in the top 5, at least the top 10. No matter how small a site is, just because there's so much garbage out there. Okay? And finally, if you're doing business to business requirements. So here in the United States, we have an interesting situation. It's somewhat unique to the United States, although we're starting to see kind of parallel things emerge around the world. But in America, you have something called Section 508. Has anybody ever heard of that? Okay. Section 508 is part of the, it's not ADA. It's the other one, Rehabilitation Act, believe it or not. At any rate, it's a federal statute in the United States, and essentially what it says is that if you are on the chart, and the chart essentially boils down to if your content is funded by public dollars, I mean, that's a broad generalization, but if it's public money, then your web content must be Section 508 compliant. But 508 goes further than that because it also says that you can only do businesses with companies that are 508 compliant as well. So about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, as this law was coming to fruition back in Washington, there was a software company that you've probably heard of before called Adobe that started freaking out because one of the premier products that Adobe had shipped and sold to large government institutions all over the place was Adobe Acrobat, right? PDF. And in those days, PDFs were essentially giant pictures. That's what they were. And it was great if you wanted to digitally send information that could be printed. Right, so you could send a PDF from Washington to San Francisco, and the guy in San Francisco could print it out. So it was, in some ways, a glorified fax, but, you know, whatever. But all of the accessibility bits was not there. And so Adobe spent, I don't know how much money and time and effort, and they had to completely refactor and re-engineer the way PDF was built. And they did, from the ground up. They rebuilt PDF so that it could, in fact, be accessible. Why? Because if they didn't, they wouldn't be able to sell PDF to the U.S. federal government, which is the largest customer in the world, the end, right? So there are business reasons if you want to do business with public institutions that you have to have accessible content. Finally, there's legal reasons. So we talked about Target.com a little bit, and Target actually ended up being settled out of court. What we have right now is a situation where most of the legislation that exists around the world, not just here in the United States, but around the world, remains untested. There's been about four or five cases that have actually appeared before a magistrate. The very first one was back in 2000, 2001, the Sydney Olympics in Sydney, Australia. And there was a blind user in Australia that actually sued the Sydney Olympic Organizing Committee and I think it was IBM, I don't remember, but the company that actually built the website because the site was inaccessible. And it went all the way through the court system, and the judge did in fact rule that yes, the site was inaccessible and it was in contravention of Australian law, and they were awarded compensation, they were awarded a penalty, and the Olympic Committee was also told that they had to make their website accessible. The problem is that by the time the judge actually made his pronouncement, the Olympics had come and gone, and you know, it was a year later type of thing. But that was a win. The first challenge that ever really made it into the courts in the United States was against Southwest Airlines, I believe. And the judge in Florida didn't really get the whole thing and ruled that, you know, just because the Southwest had provided a 1-800 number on their website, you could phone the 1-800 number and get the seat sale prices and all that. And a lot of people were really upset about that. But since then, we've really not had a whole bunch. There's been some significant out-of-court settlements, Target being one in New York State. There was two travel sites that settled out of court and paid a bunch of money and whatnot. And we're starting to see what's called negotiated settlements happening. But the laws are becoming more and more pervasive and prevalent in insisting that web content be accessible. And there are advocacy groups out there like the NFB that are really pushing that envelope a lot. So it's going to be increasingly become a factor for businesses that are using the web as part of their business infrastructure to ensure that they're not excluding anybody. So again, starting from the beginning and building accessible web content is a proactive measure because, you know, even though the liabilities are untested, who needs the negative publicity, right? Getting it. I love this. Just let you read it and think about it for a second. You want me to read it aloud? It says, on my income tax 1040, it says, check this box if you are blind. I wanted to put a check mark about 3 inches away. Okay, and that's a quote from Tom Lehrer lecturing on the nature of math back in 1990. So it's an interesting comment, but it kind of sort of drives home to the heart of the matter. Okay, is you got to think about this, you know, and so creating web content technically is not very difficult. I mean, I could work with a web developer and in about 2 days probably give them all of the skills that they would require to build websites that are, for the most part, fully accessible. There's some really minor nuances. I mean, I really dance on the edges right now, but I've been doing it for 10 years. But for a mainstream web developer working in Silicon Valley today, the techniques that they needed to use, I could teach them in probably 2 days. But the single most important thing is you got to get your head into the game. You got to understand what's going on. Okay? So, if you're a content author, and this is, here's now your skills, and I'm going to give it to you in 5 minutes or less, okay? If you're a content author, the most important thing that you can do to ensure accessible web content is something called semantic structure. And what that means is, and actually you can tell how old this slide is because this is the really old screenshot from Microsoft Word. And so now we've got the ribbon across the top. But whether you've got the drop-down dialog or the ribbon, in Microsoft Word, you've got heading 1, heading 2, heading 3, and so on. Okay? And so what that does is that provides a structured outline that visually you see it getting bigger or smaller, and so you understand a parent and child relationship here. But that structure is also being embedded into your source code. And so when you develop web documents, just like you develop Word documents, the ability to do this kind of structuring is important, right? So that's an integral thing for anybody that's writing for the web. Be aware as well of things, what I refer to as spatial awareness, right? If you tell a user to click the button on the left and you're blind, where's left? Where's right? Right? So you want to think about the words that you use. You want to avoid things like click here. You go to a news site, any news site out there today, and you go to a news site and they'll have the top 4 headlines. And there's the headline, there's the little lead, right, the little bumper that sort of teases you, and then it says more... Okay. Screen readers are an interesting product because they allow blind users to consume web content. But when a web page loads up, the very first thing you do, whether you're conscious of it or not, is you scan the entire page and you take a mental snapshot of what's going on. And so you understand that more and more and more and more relates to the various headlines. Screen readers, one of the things that they can do is they can go to a website and they can hit a key press combination that will bring up all of the links on the page as a discrete table. And so what the screen reader will say is there's a link to more, a link to more, a link to more, and a link to more. So which more would you like to go to? Right? So when you're creating that text, the hyperlink text that takes you somewhere, be very specific. The text that is the link that you click on should make sense when taken out of context. There's some tricks that we can do, but instead of saying more of news article boo and more of news article foo and more of news article bar and what have you, so that it actually makes sense. You want to be using clear and jargon-free language as much as possible. Okay? Acronyms will kill people. And it's really funny because acronyms is a very important thing within our society. We use acronyms all the time. Right? But up in Canada, when I was doing my consulting work, one of my main clients was the Treasury Board Secretariat. And so within the government of Canada, everybody refers to the Treasury Board Secretariat as TBS. Well, what's TBS to you guys? Very funny, right? It's a TV show. It's a cable network, right? And so if I start talking about TBS, you're going to stop and say, well, what's he talking about? Right? So you want to be careful when you use acronyms and abbreviations. And one of the rules is that you can use them, but if you're going to use them on a web page, the first time you want to invoke an acronym or abbreviation, spell it all out and then put the abbreviation in brackets. Okay? Don't just do it on the first page of a 10-page website, because we know that search engines will deep link into your site. They won't always take you to the home page. So if you're going to use that acronym, spell it on every page. And then, if you are, in fact, the author and you're going to be handing some of this off to the development team and you're using images, provide some suggestive text to be associated with the image. And so when you're building a web page, when you put a picture on a web page, in the source code that's being used to create the website, we have what's called alternative text. And essentially that's there for screen readers. It'll tell them what the picture is. Or if you're using a text-only browser or something like that. But here's the thing. If I said that this was a picture bottle of water, it would be accurate, but it may not in fact be why I'm putting that picture on the page, because maybe instead what I wanted to really point out was that it was crystal glazer water, because it's a site about that. So you want the reason for an image on a web page is contextual, and so the alt text needs to try and convey some of that context. So if you're writing content, provide those suggestions. If you're a designer, I asked how many people here were kind of in the graphics realm and whatnot. There's a couple things you need to be aware of. One of them is color and contrast issues, foreground and background color. There are, in fact, algorithms that can programmatically determine whether your foreground and background is appropriate or not. If anybody's interested in that, contact me and I can give you the tools for that. But anyway, we want to make sure that we have sufficient contrast for people with low vision. In terms of the design, a design that can grow or expand depending on the size of the monitor, the size of the viewport is the preferred method forward, right? You also want to have scalable design so that people can enlarge or reduce the size of the text on the screen to their preference. And you want to be really, really careful of icons. Icons can be meaningless out of context, right? So one of my favorite ones is a magnifying glass. So if you see a magnifying glass on a page, what does it mean? How many people think it means to enlarge the text? Okay. Or search, right? But it could be one or the other. It's ambiguous, right? So you want to be careful about the use of icons. And contrast issues, right? You never want to use color alone to convey some information, because not everybody is going to be using a color monitor, for example, or perhaps they're colorblind. You can't really see it in the screen capture here, but here I've got canceled by vendor is a yellow X and refused is a red X. And in the black and white screen capture, it's a gray X. That's a gray X. So, you know, you want to be really careful about things like that. From a technical perspective, the way modern web development has evolved, it's a three-legged chair. And so at the base, we have HTML, which is the authoring language to create web pages. That's where your semantic structure is, headings, paragraphs, lists, those kinds of things. On one side, we have scripting. That's the interactive stuff. That's what makes pages do things. And on the other side, we have something called CSS, or cascading style sheets. And that's where all of your design information goes. And the basic principle is that you can cut off one of these arms. You should still be able to get the meat of the information on any given web page, right? This is the foundation. This is the structure of your content. This is how you make it look nice, and this is how you make it work nice. But if I take one of these away, I should still be able to function with the content, that it should be complete just like that. And so that's the basic building blocks, and that's the basic foundation of web accessibility. I told you I'd give it to you all in 5 minutes. So, does anybody have any questions? David.
Well, you mentioned that technology is advancing, and I know that's more complex information and videos and stuff is going up there. So is the situation getting easier, or is it getting more confusing?
Well, in some ways it's getting easier, and in other ways it's getting more complicated, right? That's kind of the way of the world. So in terms of the technology, adaptive technology, computer technology is getting significantly better. I hate very much to focus only on screen readers, because web accessibility is more than just making web content for the blind. But the reality is that out of all the user groups, they're the ones that are most significantly impacted 90% of the time. The screen reading technology up until about a year and a half, 2 years ago, was extremely expensive. The most common software package is a program called JAWS, and JAWS will run you about $1,000, right? There's now free open source screen readers out there. There's a tool called NVDA, which will run on the Windows platform. I'm not sure if they've ported it to Linux yet, but there are free screen readers on the Linux platform. Apple has done a lot of work with VoiceOver. So in terms of putting the tools in the hands of people with disabilities, we're seeing great strides. So it's making it a lot easier for the consumers to consume web content. That being said, the technology is also racing ahead at a really rapid rate, and so sometimes keeping the accessibility piece of the puzzle in sync with the advances is the challenge. So I do a fair amount of work within the W3C, within the standards process, and they're currently working on the next generation of web authoring language. It's called HTML5. And there's some really cool stuff coming out of HTML5. And one of the things that they've got is, today if you want to see a video on a website, you need to have a Flash plugin that receives the video. But they're introducing a new video element so that you'll be able to play movies on a web page with no plugins. So it's really cool, and it's shipping in browsers today, and there's some test examples out there that you can actually go and try it out. But the problem is that while they defined how to embed a movie into a web page without using a plugin, they haven't quite figured out yet how to ensure that the captioning piece is included as well, right? So for me, I mean, that's kind of like, wow, that's a great car, and it looks really sharp, but you haven't tested the brakes yet? You know, and that's kind of what we have. And so, you know, now the accessibility community is scrambling to keep up with this, because it can be done. We've pretty much figured out how to do it, but we got to convey that back to the browser manufacturers. They all have to agree on the technology. They have to implement it into their browsers so that it will then ship. So, I mean, that's evolving on a daily basis, and Lord knows my inbox some days, it evolves on an hourly basis. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So, there's advances being made, but it's a struggle to keep up all the time. Hi. So, my focus is mostly working with faculty and staff. So some of the things you may not see as kind of really jumping out and biting you on the nose. One of the things that we've seen here at Stanford is a move towards a new publishing platform called Drupal, which is a software package that you put up, and then it allows authors to actually add content to the database without having to touch any of the templates that are used to display on screen. And so the fewer people you have poking away at sort of source code, not really knowing what they're doing. And so what we had 10 years ago was, you know, and I hate to say this dismissively, but work with me here, is that somebody within a department, you know, perhaps the administrative assistant, you know, the same person that put the key in the door in the morning and puts the key in at night and makes sure that the coffee's on kind of thing, you know, was handed a copy of Dreamweaver and said, congratulations, you're now the webmaster. They had no training, they had no experience, they really didn't know, and so they muddled their way through. They kind of just, you know, and I have a saying that I use all the time, you don't know what you don't know. So they didn't know about any of this accessibility stuff. Nobody told them, right? They were handed a software tool and said, congratulations, you're now in charge of the website. You know, so the education piece has been a significant part. I've spent a lot of time on that. This move towards Drupal now, people, the subject matter experts can focus on the stuff that they are experts at without worrying about how to build a website. That's all being handled by a software program. So that's one of the things that we're starting to see. A very specific thing is, and again, I mentioned I'm very passionate about web video right now, and so we've created a tool here on campus that's available to faculty and staff that they can actually upload a video, and we will get the caption piece done automatically. There's a small cost involved, because what happens is we actually take the audio piece of the movie and we send it out to a transcription company that converts it from the sound of the voices to text. We experimented with software that goes speech to text, and the accuracy rate was not good enough for our needs. So we outsourced that, and we've got a program, because we're doing it in bulk, we've been able to get the prices quite low. It's down to about $1.50 a minute, which means to get a 10-minute video caption would cost you $15. So, you know. Yeah? Drupal, D-R-U-P-A-L. So descriptive video is probably one of the hardest things to do, and the reason for that is multifold. First of all, for those that aren't aware what descriptive audio is for people that can't see what's going on the screen, we need to sort of describe it. And so here's a common scenario. You have a man and a woman, and they're arguing. And so the back and forth, there's a really sort of heated exchange. Well, a blind person can sort of follow the dialogue and can understand that there's something very kind of agitated happening on screen. But what they might not realize is that the man goes over and he grabs something and he's going to hit the woman. And that's all being done on screen, so people who can see it understand what's happening. But if the dialogue is such that they're back and forth and back and forth, there's nowhere to actually sort of stop and insert the description that says, you know, Bob picked up a heavy skillet and is going to hit his wife. I mean, there's no way of doing it. So that's a real problem. It's further complicated in the commercial production field, because writing descriptive audio or descriptive text is extremely complex, and you have to hire additional voice talent, and they have to find a place to insert it in between pauses and whatnot. So I did see an experiment. It was actually quite fascinating. It came out of the IBM research labs out of Tokyo. The guy's going to be at CSUN, and if anybody here is going to CSUN, I don't know him. I highly urge you to go check it out, where he's used, beside the viewport screen, there's a little pane that actually has the descriptive dialogue, I'll call it that, but it's there in text. And so for blind users that use screen reading technology, if ever you've ever experienced screen readers, it'll blow you away, because a really adept screen reader will turn the screen reading voice up to about 500 words a minute. That's astronomical, because most human beings, I've been talking fast today, and I know that, you know, most human beings talk at somewhere between 60 and 85 words a minute. So when a screen reader users turn their speech rate up to 500 words a minute, it means that what would normally take me 5 minutes to tell you, they can do in a minute. What would normally take me 5 seconds to tell you, they can do in 1 second. And so using the advantage of the technology, this software developer out of Tokyo is doing just that. And so now you can hit pause very quickly on the thing, and the screen reader, you know, will tell you what's going on, and you can resume to the on-screen dialogue. And it's very much less intrusive than, you know, having an actual moderated voice. So, but it's one of the areas where we're really, there's not a lot of work done yet. So I wanted to ask 3 questions quickly, and we've got probably 3 minutes. So one of the things I wanted to do, and maybe it's not appropriate today, is I was going to say, what are some of the major sites that you use? You know, so how many people here goes to Yahoo on a regular basis? No? Okay, how about Facebook? Yeah, I knew that one. And so, you know, we're starting to see some of these sites emerge that have become part of our day-to-day society. Okay, Facebook, so-so. Yahoo's done a lot of work to improve the accessibility of their web content, and it's very much a cultural thing within their organization, right? Anybody that gets hired to work at Yahoo today, before they write any code that's going to go out, they have to go through a one-day boot camp on accessibility. And my good friend Victor Saron, you should ask Victor to come and do a demonstration someday. Victor is a blind engineer. He's from Russia or Romania or something like that. And he runs a lab at Yahoo. The developers can come and they can test their stuff. And he runs a one-day boot camp that just kind of helps the developers get their head into the game, right? So has anybody ever noticed a website that they felt was probably inaccessible? There was something about a website that was inaccessible or didn't work for them? Can I ask you what it was?
Well, I have only 1% vision, and I don't see contrast well. It was light blue letters on a slightly lighter blue background.
Yeah, contrast issues is a common issue. Because the thing is that contrast sort of falls into the realm of design, right? And so the designers have a very big stick when you sit around the table. The engineers are going, well, we can do this and we can do that, and, you know, engineering, we can do anything, right? And the designers go, yes, but, you know, we have to have soothing shades of gray. And I'm being a little facetious here, but, I mean, the reality is that when you have large web projects, there's many voices sitting around the table. And so there's always a tension, you know, between the different players. And all too often, the web accessibility guy doesn't get invited to that meeting. I know because I'm him. So the last question I was going to say is, what do you think you should do if you notice an accessibility problem on a website? I'm sorry?
Oh, sue the bastard.
So that's one strategy. And surprisingly enough, that strategy is being dug out of the toolbox more frequently now. But yeah, I mean, that tends to be the end game. What I would suggest to you is this. If ever you come across a website that has an access problem or an accessibility problem, or you think it's a problem, tell them, right? People want to know. And it comes down to what I said earlier. People don't know what they don't know. The awareness of a web accessibility is increasing significantly and has been doing so for about 5 years now. We're getting there. It's been a long haul, but we're starting to get there. But if you see something that doesn't work for you, chances are it's not working for somebody else as well. So tell them. A nice, politely worded email. I noticed the following issues, and I wanted to bring it to your attention. Half the time, better than half the time, you'll probably get an email back saying, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention. And then we'll either do what we can to fix it, or it's a known issue, right? There are means and methods of accelerating it if you really do feel that you've been aggrieved, right? But I would start off by use the velvet glove first. And if you want, you can contact me and I'd be more than happy to help you understand if there is an issue and work through that as well. So to that end, there's handouts at the back. I also left a stack of business cards there. And thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Right on. Well, did you say 5:30?